Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week we are covering Ned's ascent to the Iron Throne. In fact, we see the introduction to the Iron Throne. This is where Ned dispatches Beric Dondarrion and company to go deal with the Mountain. My guest this week is Carol Parrish Jameson. She is professor at Georgia Southern University. You should absolutely check out her book, Chivalry in Westeros, The Knightly Code of A Song of Ice and Fire. Carol is helping me continue the theme of knights and chivalry, and there is no one better. She is an expert on the codes that make knights. Her book is great for comparing the codes of Westeros and the codes of the medieval world. And then Steve and I continue our trek through season 5. And finally, in my bird's eye view, I read a few pages from a short essay that Martin wrote about Daemon Targaryen. So mild spoilers in the bird's eye view section. But I think I revealed just enough to give you a taste of Daemon's character. I don't reveal too much about the plot. That said, if you want to avoid spoilers, just go ahead and skip that section this week. Without further ado, here is Professor Carol Parrish Jameson. We can just go ahead and start by talking about your book. What's the title?
The title is Chivalry in Westeros.
And 2018, McFarlane, right? And so people can probably find that on the McFarlane website. But of course, as with all things, you can probably do a quick search on Amazon.
Yes, you can.
And find it that way. So tell me a little bit about the book, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so in this book, I talk about how Martin reworks not just the chivalric code, but other warrior codes as well, specifically the chivalric code, and how his works intersect with medieval romance and heroic works and their depictions of the chivalric code. And I'm most interested in how he teases out the contradictions that are inherent in that code.
All right, I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
It's a little bit of a rhetorical question.
Sure.
But I'm curious to see how you reply. Does the code make the knight, or does the knight make the code?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, in theory, the code makes the knight.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I think, in theory, right?
Right. In theory. Again, the problem is that the code is, it sets up ideals, and ideals indicate perfection, and there's no such thing in perfection, so you can really only fail. So there is no perfect knight, even in medieval romance, even Galahad, for example. He's the perfect knight, but he gives up one whole aspect that's typically associated with chivalry, and that's love of ladies, right? Because he's chaste. So to be the perfect knight, you would have to live up to all of these ideals, and no one ever quite does it.
Well, I have a question, and I was wondering for our listeners who might be interested. It seems like there's this, from the early medieval period to the late 1500s, the concept of knighthood really evolves.
It does.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that evolution, maybe beginning with, you know, the idea of sort of just the horseman, you know, the guy who's good on horseback riding around the countryside of France to maybe what we see in more of like the 1200s.
Right. Yeah. So I would probably go back to talk about the warrior code. of I focus primarily on England. So the heroic code that you see in works like Beowulf and the Battle of Maldon, you know, at this point they're not knights, they're warriors, but they're predecessors to, I think, what becomes the chivalric code, in that other things are involved in addition to prowess, such as loyalty, which is a very big part of the chivalric code once the chivalric code comes into play. So we're kind of all set up for the chivalric code, which comes in really in a way like through the troubadours, and then through the writings of patrons of women, really, like Eleanor of Aquitaine and Marie de Champagne, who add these other elements into it, almost softer elements that we associate with chivalry, such as courtesy, behavior towards women, which is not considered a part of the heroic code. And so it begins to highlight more the term courtesy itself. Originally meant, behavior at court. So that becomes more of a focus as well. And so we see that beginning to evolve in works like the Song of Roland is a French work that's really more of an epic, but it's sort of transitioning us into more chivalric kinds of works. With the Arthurian tradition, we have early works that just give Arthur a life story. And then later, other writers come in and start adding in these elements of chivalry.
Interesting.
Is that going where you wanted it to go?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And so then I guess the next question is, so these ideals really get traction, right?
They do.
So you get these not just courtly, but also religious elements to the office of a knight.
Right.
But then I guess I want to talk about sort of the twilight of knighthood. Like, how does it go away? Like, why does it go away?
Well, it largely goes away when guns come into play. That changes that changes the whole landscape.
Sure.
But it's interesting because,
literally can go away now.
Right. Different ballgame. But we can think, of works like Sir Thomas Malory's The Death of Arthur, which, we take the legend of King Arthur specifically, who I guess is who we think of when we think quintessentially about the chivalric code. And, the demise of Arthur, and clearly Malory is writing near the waning of the Middle Ages, right? He's 15th century. But there are contradictions within the chivalric code way earlier, even I think as early as Chrétien de Troyes, who is the first writer of romance, we often call him at least. He invented the character of Lancelot. And Lancelot's, Lancelot is in quite a dilemma, right, as far as chivalry goes. Because he's loyal to Arthur. He's Arthur's best knight. He's supposed to be a Christian knight. And you have to be loyal to your lady. Well, what happens when your lady is married to your king?
Right.
And, you're at a contradiction there with religion as well. So I would say that, yes, it evolves, it wanes. But there are contradictions within that code, I think, throughout the period.
Right. And basically, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that... There were some structural problems with these codes from the beginning.
Exactly.
And it was something that probably wasn't going to last because no matter what, a knight trying to live up to every ideal was simply going to fail.
Right. And I think it simply offered an ideal, something aspirational. Rather than realistic, and there's always a sense of nostalgia about it. The golden age of Arthur, this time that never existed.
Yeah.
So there is always a certain nostalgia that I see Martin working with that as well when he talks about the White Book, where, the stories of old, how the knights used to be.
Right, right. All right, I'm going to read a short synopsis of this chapter.
Okay.
Okay, so here's my synopsis. Ned is sitting without comfort upon the Iron Throne. Baelish, Varys, Pycelle, a number of petitioners and observers are before him. The petitioners represent several villages that have been ravaged by so-called brigands. But the repeated claim is that these brigands represent House Lannister. Ned suspects that this violence is yet another consequence of Tyrion's capture. Even so, he must have proof that these were indeed Lannister men. The best proof of the matter is that Gregor Clegane was seen among the criminals. Ned refuses Pycelle's plea to dismiss the case and dismisses Loras's veiled appeal for vengeance. Instead, he commissions Beric Dondarrion and company to bring justice to the so-called false knight, Gregor Clegane. Afterward, Varys notes that Ned might have insulted both Loras and Ilyn Payne. So, Carol Jamieson, would you like to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
Well, of course, I want to talk about the theme of chivalry, but I would like to get there via the ladder of chaos.
All right. Well, we'll let you take the first. We'll let you go first on this. I'm fascinated to hear how someone who's an expert on chivalry reads this chapter.
Yeah, it's funny. This I don't think I paid a lot of attention to this chapter in the past, but it's setting up a lot of things, a lot of events to come. But there really is a lot to unpack here. And the first thing I think that really strikes me about it is Eddard, the position that Eddard is in. And I think more than maybe anywhere else in the novels, I appreciated just how horribly uncomfortable that throne is.
Yeah,
he can, the blades, but, and he's in this, he is in this position where he's caught himself within, the code of honor that he believes in and, and what he should do. I find him kind of a hard character to read. I don't know. Do you?
Ned?
Yes.
You know, it's interesting. I think that that's most people's encounter with Ned. And I even think that that might be Martin's encounter with Ned. I don't feel like, I think Ned kind of represents something that Martin wants to deconstruct. But I've been reading this book alongside several, close readers like yourself. And I think that the variety of opinions about Ned have helped reshape the way I see him. I've developed a little bit more sympathy for his situation. But I like that you're bringing up the Iron Throne here. I think this is the first time we've seen anyone sit on the Iron Throne in this book.
It may be. Yeah, it may be.
And it really does, the metaphor, Aegon's metaphor of the throne really is illustrated well. Ned's uncomfortable up there for several reasons.
Right.
But it's also literally uncomfortable. And I think that it very well could be that Ned's was in an impossible situation from the beginning. And even if he was a brilliant strategist, he's not going to be in a great position.
No, he isn't. He's got the dilemma here. His wife is a Tully, and this attack is against Tullys. He believes in honor. He keeps talking about vengeance versus justice, and he's trying to exact justice. And yet, I can't help thinking that he doesn't want to, extend a little vengeance there as well. He's angry.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely want to get to that. The difference between justice and vengeance. I'm curious about the phrase false knight, and I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on the concept of a true knight, a false knight. Like, what are we talking about?
Right. Yeah. Well, let's start with what is a true knight? So what should a true knight do? A true knight, it's interesting for Martin, the term, I think that term comes up most often via Sansa. You are no true knight, but she has this idea of her idea of what a true knight is. It's false. It's fictionalized. She has this, this vision, this kind of fictionalized vision of it. A true knight should defend the realm, defend the king, show honor, loyalty, bravery. Those are the things that a true knight should have good intentions. It's interesting when you look at these, there are medieval kind of handbooks of chivalry, one by a man named Raymond Lull. And he says things like a true knight performs true deeds. And it sort of almost goes in a circle with what a true knight should do.
Right, of course. Well, sure. I mean, what he's not saying is that if you are a true knight, then any deed you perform will be true. And yet, this is sort of back to my original question, does the code make the knight or does the knight make the code? I think that, of course, Sansa is drawing a lot from fiction in her concept of a true knight. But like you said before, the concept was always something of an aspirational office.
Right. Yeah.
So those fictions that Sansa's reading or, you know, we mentioned Lancelot earlier. They do some of the work that's necessary to create that kind of aspiration.
Right. Yeah, they do. It's, you know, it's all very idealized and polished. And whereas Martin is showing us kind of the ugly underbelly, right? this other side of it.
Right.
Another question would be, who is a true knight within the realm of Westeros? And that gets, that's a very difficult question to answer as well. Of course, it's probably Brienne, who can't really be a knight.
Right. Yeah. Well, all right. Okay, good. All right. Then let's talk about the ideal of, or the idea of a false knight. What would it take for someone to be a false knight?
So someone to be a false knight, I think they would be taking advantage for their own good. Mm. Actually, I'm going to read a little passage from one of these medieval handbooks on knighthood that talks about it. Okay, so this is, I've got a couple here. This is from Geoffroy de Charny, who was writing in the 14th century. And his book is A Knight's Own Book of Chivalry. That's comes from. This is from a section called Those Unworthy to Be Men at Arms. He says, those men who take up arms but are not men of arms, nor should be because of their dishonest and disordered behavior, these men want to wage war without good reason. They seize other people without prior warning and without any good cause, and rob and steal from them, wound and kill them. Mm. Those who use arms in this dishonorable way behave like cowards and traitors. And he goes on from there. But it sounds like a pretty apt description of what Gregor Clegane has done.
Right. Right. And yet it's interesting that we have Pycelle's voice in this chapter who's saying he couldn't have done this. He's an anointed knight.
Right. You know,
there's almost that kind of tautology that you were calling out earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It almost presupposes that there's no such thing as a false knight. Of course, Pycelle, we know, is sort of a creature of the Lannisters.
Exactly, right.
So, you know, his logic is flawed from the beginning. But clearly, this concept has to be in place because, of course, men are flawed. And not every person who holds the office is going to be, quote unquote, true.
Right. But one can try to be true.
That's
the other point. What interests me, too, about Martin's portrayals of chivalry are how characters work within the contradictions of chivalry. So that Ned Stark, I think he believes so staunchly in the code that he follows that he's not always able to follow through with the nuances.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like Gregor Clegane, he doesn't care. He's almost beyond the realm. He almost, to me, is like a Grendel, like a monster.
Interesting. Well, he literally becomes a monster, right?
He literally becomes a monster. And so I think he almost is beyond, kind of beyond. He's off the chart. The only virtue that I could imagine that he has, obviously, he has amazing prowess, right? That he's got this great physical strength.
Right.
But he uses it without any reserve, without any sense of honor. And I think honor is a big part of the chivalric code. And he serves Tywin Lannister, but I don't think there's loyalty there. I think, you know, he just does Tywin's bidding as sort of an excuse to go out and kill because he's a killer, right?
Right. I mean, now that we have the spectrum, you know, we've got Brienne on one end.
Mm-hmm.
And Gregor Clegane on the other. You know, even if both are questionably knights, right?
Right.
Gregor is an anointed knight, but now we're calling him a false knight. Mm-hmm. And of course, in many ways, Brienne is the knightly ideal, and yet she can't hold that title or office or something like that.
Right.
All right, so we've got these ends of the spectrum, and yet most of Martin's characters are somewhere in between.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
It's almost like those contradictions that you were noting.
Mm-hmm.
Can you really be true if part of your job involves killing, right?
Right.
And, you know, that's basically you're a warrior. And, of course, war is this hellish state, of course. So how can you remain true in this context?
Right. And there are, again, the competing demands of the chivalric code is that ultimately, how can you do that?
Yeah.
So even, you know, Sor Loras, who looks to be the flower of chivalry, right? Literally,
right. Yeah,
the knight
yeah.
of the flowers.
It clearly, Sansa thinks so, right?
Right. She thinks so. But he has a thirst for vengeance. Ned sees that. He's a bit too enthusiastic. He doesn't have the restraint that perhaps, you know, that gets him in trouble later on. And I think that's why Ned isn't sending him, because he knows that he has a kind of a vendetta against Gregor. I guess there's a way to go about it. So that going back to that tournament, one of the things that makes Gregor such a monster is that he kills the squire, Hugh, but he goes for him because he sees that he hasn't properly attached part of his neck armor.
Mm-hmm.
And so he takes advantage of a weakness. And then when he begins fighting with his own brother, you know, he's unhelmeted, and his brother knows you don't fight unhelmeted. Mm. So there's violence, but there also are rules.
Right.
And Gregor doesn't obey the rules.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And yet I think that there might be a little bit of a mirror back on Ned in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I agree.
You know,
yeah.
So there's this concept of true knighthood. And of course, we've got a few examples of this, even in the room. You know, Loras is in mm-hmm. the room asking for, quote unquote, justice.
Right.
And yet maybe he'll take a little bit too much joy in administering mm-hmm. the justice. So, of course, Ned has to, you know, bring someone else in.
Right. Sure. Even though it would have been a good alliance, as Pycelle points out to him.
Exactly. Exactly. And yet Ned, what is Ned? Ned is, you know, Ned is not a knight, quote unquote. And yet he's sitting on 1,000 swords.
Right.
You know, a lot of those coming from knights. And of course, mm-hmm. the swords are something of a metaphor for what the king is meant to do.
You know, right.
In ruling, the king is both conqueror and peacemaker. And of course, this is a contradiction. And here Ned is trying to keep the peace and bring justice. And yet he's not going to be very comfortable in this position because, of course, this position is a contradiction.
It is a contradiction. And he's in a position where he's speaking for the king. He says he's speaking for Robert. But what he commands to have done, I am not so sure Robert would have done. So I think when Ned says,
no, it's an assault on the Lannisters. Robert can't do that.
So when he says he's, you know, he's the hand of the king, mm-hmm. he's speaking in the king's voice, I think he's speaking in the voice of what he sees as the ideal leader, perhaps.
Yes, that's right.
But, you know, the mission that he's sending these men on to, you know, to bring Gregor Clegane to justice is going to cause all kinds of other conflicts. But what can Ned do, right? He is completely caught in this situation.
That's
right. He can't do nothing.
Well, I think that, I mean, he's got a couple advisors who are basically mm-hmm. saying, yes, Ned, do nothing. You know, the mm-hmm. Pycelle certainly.
Right.
Certainly has his agenda. But also Baelish is saying, well, you know, they're on war horses, but, you know, they could have stolen these war horses from, you know, the last raid. So you really don't know. You really don't have enough information, Ned.
Right.
To make any kind of proclamation here. Of course, Ned, you know, Ned is convinced that these are Lannisters. And for all of his honor, the sending of these, I guess, men of justice to go after Gregor Clegane, even if it is done so for the sake of some sort of ideal leader,
mm-hmm.
It actually will help his wife's cause.
It will, which means that he's not really speaking. as the king, there might be a little self-interest.
Yeah, a little again to the impossibility of this, and of course, Varys is going to step in and say, "Hey, you could have killed two birds with one stone here, Ned. You could mm-hmm. have allied with the Tyrells."
Mm-hmm.
Simply by making an arrangement with Loras. Why not do both at the same time? Why not improve the kingdom by bringing justice, but also do something that's more advantageous for House Stark?
That seems like a much better option, the more that I think on it.
And I think Ned really wants to believe that he can put on the garb of impartiality, right?
Right. I do believe he believes in the code that he follows. He believes in it.
Right.
Yeah. And he'll go forward with it, even though there's going to be a lot of fallout from this decision that he's making.
So with this conversation that we're having, are we, are you and I both comfortable thinking that Ned, even though not a knight, might represent something that's kind of the core to chivalry?
I believe he does. And in fact, you know, in Winterfell, when, you know, his sons are being trained, their trainer, whose name I can't think of right now, says, "I'm training knights." That obviously they have a code that parallels Bran's dream is of becoming a knight. So, you know, of course, their religion prevents them from becoming technically knights. But I believe the code of honor that they follow very closely parallels and intersects with the code of chivalry.
I think that we've known that Pycelle is pretty slimy all along. But I think that this chapter really does bring out in very obvious terms how much Pycelle is in the pocket of Tywin.
Yeah. I mean, it is circumstantial evidence that these are Lannister men, but you know, they make a good case that there's no one as large as Gregor Clegane. But Pycelle is looking for any kind of wiggle room he can to try to get the Lannisters, I guess, off the hook in this situation.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about justice versus vengeance. I think that Ned, Ned has this very clear idea about, you know, that this is an act of justice that we're enacting here. I'm sending out men to do justice, bring justice to the false knight. And he makes a distinction here between what Loras wants, which he thinks is vengeance. He calls it vengeance. And what he's asking these other knights to do, Beric Dondarrion to do. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that difference. Is there a is there a distinction? Is it too fine a distinction?
It's a fine distinction, but I think we can tease it out a little bit. So we've talked about this contradiction, you know, that's kind of inherent in the chivalric code. It involves violence. But in these handbooks of chivalry, and you see this in romance as well, that you don't want to have excessive pride and excessive ferocity, that it needs to be curbed by a good cause so that you're not killing for pleasure. And so I think that's what, that's that difference between justice and vengeance. With vengeance, you're simply, you're getting back at someone out of anger. With justice, you're doing a deed that will bring potential peace to the realm, that will give you honor.
I think that in this chapter, there's a sense that the executioner can't enjoy his work too much. You know, you know, Ned even calls out, like, look, I'm from the First Men. The First Men will always, you know, the person who administers the judgment swings the sword. And previously in his conversation with Bran, Ned explains, like, look, you got to be able to look the guy in your in the eye and make a hard decision. This should be a hard decision to make because, you know, you take no pleasure in this, in other words.
And he even, you know, he doesn't want to have to send men, but he says, you know, I'm in no condition. I'm in no condition. I can't do this myself. Therefore, you know, he's having to send men. So he does. He feels very strongly. And I think for him, that's how he would draw this distinction.
And then, of course, this plays out really brilliantly as the chapter ends. And so I'm just going to read how the chapter ends.
Okay.
This is Varys talking. Very prudent, no doubt, Varys said. Still, I chanced to see Sir Ilan in the back of the hall, staring on us with those pale eyes of his, and I must say, he did not look pleased. Though to be sure, it is hard to tell with our silent knight. I hope he outgrows his disappointment as well. He does so love his work. Right? So Ned hates executioners, right?
Right.
Because this sort of is in contradiction to the code of the First Men. And so he's not going to send Ilan Payne. He doesn't trust Ilan Payne and all of that business. But the key distinction between justice and vengeance, at least from Ned's point of view, is are you going to take pleasure in administering the execution?
Right. Yeah.
And of course, Ilan Payne loves his work, right?
Yes.
And of course, this also foreshadows Ned's ultimate fate.
Right. Yeah. It certainly does. So yeah, I think that's a key distinction there, that you don't want to take pleasure, that then you're not curbing your prowess, right? Mm-hmm. You're not, you're going forward without control, just right. with vengeance. Yeah.
So, yeah, so I think that there's an interesting distinction here. And I think that Varys, as Varys will often do, he will point out to Ned from time to time the gray areas of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll do it in such a way where you wonder, like, which way does Varys want Ned to go? Or is he kind of just enjoying observing, you know, this poor guy right. in an impossible situation?
yeah. Varys is another who, you know, his claim is for the good of the realm, Mm-hmm. But yeah, he does point out those gray areas. And again, with Ned's value system, I think maybe he sees the gray areas, but he doesn't want to work with those gray areas. He sees a real direction yeah. with the code of honor that he thinks he needs to follow. And I think that's why it doesn't end.
Right.
He's not able to work with those inherent contradictions in a way I think that some of Martin's other characters are.
Sure.
Particularly, it's a topic for another day, but I think Jaime Lannister is someone who recognizes those contradictions and kind of works with them, and I think maybe evolves. And the other one is the Hound, who I think recognizes very clearly and obviously the contradictions yeah. within the Shi'ar, and therefore refuses to be a knight. He
right.
refuses to be what his brother is, a false knight.
You're right. So, I mean, certainly the Hound has this jaded idea of what an anointed knight really is, because, of course,
yeah.
the parade example of this is his brother, mm-hmm. who's clearly an evil sociopath who's yeah. murdering without consequence.
The worst of all Westerosi knights, and that's pretty low.
I think that the Hound also recognizes some of those traits in himself and maybe
mm-hmm.
maybe doesn't quite know what to do with, you know. He's very much a soul at struggle.
Right, yeah, I agree with that.
And, of course, Jaime's in this situation early on in his life. As a very young man, he's forced to decide, do I honor and obey my father, or do I honor and obey the father of the realm, because they're giving right. me contrary instructions.
Right. And there's where he so clearly sees those contradictions. I think my favorite passage is where he's imprisoned by Catelyn and he's saying so many vows.
Yeah. Yes.
And yeah, he's torn so many ways.
What a wonderful illustration of what we've been talking
yeah,
about.
That's my favorite passage. And I can see Ned at this point kind of torn between. He's loyal to
yeah.
Robert. And he's loyal to, obviously, his wife. He feels this responsibility yeah. towards the realm. And he's angry himself. He's ticked off.
Yeah.
So he feels a little personal vengeance that he's trying to curb, I believe.
Right. I'm going to call out a few introductions.
Okay.
So notable introductions in this chapter. Carol Vance and his wine-colored birthmark. Sir Mark Piper. And although they're not named as such, we do have the introduction to the Brothers Without Banners.
Mm-hmm.
Who will become important later on, not in this book, but in future books. And maybe the most important introduction of all, introduction to the Iron Throne. We've heard of it. This is the first time we've actually seen it in action. Notable departures. No one's really departed, although we kind of have this. This is sort of the departure of Ned's short stay on the Iron Throne. I
right.
suppose.
The beginning of the end.
maybe the beginning of the end. Yeah. Yeah. And then I wanted to call out some book versus show differences.
Mm-hmm.
This one was a little bit difficult. I guess the way that the room is arranged is slightly different. It's probably not all that notable. But the Iron Throne looks much differently in the books than it does with the HBO adaptation.
It does, yeah. I think I appreciate the discomfort of it so much more in reading.
Yeah, in Martin's original vision, it's massive, mm-hmm. and it's even more uncomfortable. And it really looks like this monstrosity.
Yeah.
And, of course, I also, this is just an actor choice, but in this chapter, Beric is called a young man.
Right.
Or
yeah,
a young lord or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is certainly not the choice. But I'm completely in love with the actor who ends up playing mm-hmm. Beric. I can see no one else. I will say that there were more than one Beric. In this early first season, Beric is played by a different actor than the one who ends up dying and coming back. several times. But I guess that can age a man, you know, after several resurrections.
I want to go back to the television version, if I could, for a minute. A couple of things that struck me about it. One was we talked about Ned having really kind of circumstantial evidence. And so it was interesting to me that in the show version, they brought in that smelly bag of fish and drop it on the floor as proof that they were Tullys.
Okay.
Yeah, so they needed, and I'm saying smelly because of the faces.
I totally forgot about that, and I'm glad you brought that back.
Yeah, that they needed that extra bit of evidence, I guess.
Right.
That the TV producers decided they needed that. They also, in the chapter, I think we can more fully appreciate the atrocities that Gregor has done, because there are multiple little people speaking, right? The common folk are speaking, whereas it's sort of just one person. So, you know, another thing this chapter highlights about the chivalric code, kind of transitioning from the series back into the chapter, is the effect of warfare and the effect really of chivalry on the common folk, that they're in the wake. They're receiving a lot of devastation here, regardless, even in a so-called true war.
Right.
That, you know, the little people really suffer here, the common folk.
Again, we hear Varys's voice.
Right.
Kind of calling this out, you know.
Yeah.
For all of your honor, you know, choosing to go to war is going to bring violence to the innocent.
Right.
Yeah. So I had a question. Mm-hmm. So Renly and Selmy have gone off with Robert because a white hart has been spotted in the Kingswood.
Right.
And in my vague recollections of symbols, the white hart can sometimes be like thought of a messenger from the other side or something.
It can. It's associated like with the questing beast and the whole quest, and it's it can be highly symbolic. So I too noted that. I didn't really follow through with it as I probably should have.
Well,
but
I was wondering.
Was struck.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me more about that. I was wondering if this could be something like Robert, some sort of portent, like Robert is actually about to go to the other side.
It could be. Yeah, it well could be a bit of foreshadowing on Martin's part there, that there's this this white hart, this very rare, maybe even non-existent beast that they're questing after.
Right.
And yeah, it can take you into unknown realms.
And of course,
and certainly, that's where Robert's headed.
And of course, Robert's sigil is the stag.
The stag, right. Yeah, yeah. And even, you know, I'm thinking now back to our setting here in this chapter, that Ned notices, well, the dragons are no longer there, but there are these tapestries that have the stags on them. Mm-hmm. But all he can see is blood, right? That he sees, he has a little bit of this sense of portents as well.
You know, that little note also has an echo in Arya's narrative. Arya has a dream that the Red Keep has like walls dripping with blood.
She does, yeah.
And she, after that, recalling that dream, she ends up hearing Varys and Illyrio talk about one hand can die, so can another. And so I think Martin is calling us back to that portent.
Yeah, it's certainly that the language here does parallel that language that he uses to describe Arya's dream.
You really get the sense that the Red Keep is not a good place to be. It's
right.
You can die like Jon Arryn pretty easily.
It's uncomfortable. Yeah, it's uncomfortable for Ned in every way.
He knows
that the code that they're following, you know, is at odds with his own, and only bad things can happen.
Yeah.
And so I think that his observation about the Red could be, him kind of foreseeing that this is a tough situation and it's probably not going to end well.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I cover episode 4 of season 5. Jorah and Tyrion are in a boat. Margaery and Cersei continue their power plays with Tommen as a pawn. Jon Snow deals with the duties of Lord Commander up at the Wall. And the Dorne plot continues to be the Dorne plot. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, if you could choose a character to be your boss in this show, a character to be a co-worker in the show, and a character to be your employee. So anyone that you've met in the world of Game of Thrones, you've got to choose to be a boss, a co-worker, an employee.
Probably as an employee, I think I'd like Jack and Hagar.
oh, really?
Yeah.
You want to murder some dudes.
Well, I like the idea that as soon as I kind of know what motivates them, I can get them to do whatever I want.
Okay. All right.
And they'll finish the project, right?
Yeah, he seems intent to finish the project. In fact, if the project is killing himself, he may kill himself.
Yeah. Co-worker.
That would save you a lot on a severance package.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the co-worker probably go with Davos just because he seems like a reasonable conversationalist. You know, I mean, he's got a lot of good traits. He's the kind of guy I bet you like I could probably move some of my own projects for him to do, and he would almost feel like it'd be an honor.
All right. Well, you know what? I'll tell you what, man. These are two characters that I would have never imagined, but I'm buying it. Like, I totally see that. All right. So now you choose your own boss.
Hodor.
So you want a boss that doesn't know he's your boss?
Yes. Yeah. I've had a lot of managers over my life, and I've worked at places that have had a lot of turnover, and I felt like I spend a lot of time trying to manage up. It'd be nice to not really have to do that.
I wouldn't have seen any of these coming. Here's what I was thinking.
Okay.
I was thinking I want Tyrion as my boss.
Okay.
I feel like Tyrion treats Pod really well.
Good. Yeah, that's fair.
And I mean, even when Shaga was around, I never felt like he was. I think Shaga had it pretty good. Coworker, I was thinking Jaime Lannister, because I just like talking mess. You know,
you don't think he might be gunning for your job at some point, or?
Well, we're coworkers. I mean, he's got my job.
Well, I know, but like everybody's looking to advance, right?
Not Jaime. Jaime doesn't want to advance.
Good point. That's fair.
All right. So, and then I was thinking, as my employee, I was thinking Pod, just because he's not great, but he's earnest and he's trying hard.
No, I can see that. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to work for the smoke baby.
You don't have anything to do with the smoke baby.
Yeah, I don't even really want to work for me. But I mean, if I had to choose one of the three, I guess I'd rather have the smoke baby clocking in, so I kind of keep an eye on him.
All right. So, something that worked for you this episode.
There were a couple things I rather enjoyed. Still enjoy the poor Tommen. This Tommen. I mean, Cersei is like full on, right? I mean, Cersei's pretty impressive with what she's doing, and very calculated. I mean, really, really strutting her stuff in the way that she can sort of keep her hands clean and really manipulate a lot of what's going on in King's Landing. So this was what I had made in the note of. This was like my favorite thing. But then Tyrion with a gag in his mouth clearly is highlight of this episode. Like, everything was like super interesting. But man, the so good.
I love that too, and I feel like I've got my old Tyrion back.
Yeah,
you know, and he's just trying to exchange barbs with Jorah, and Jorah just really likes to punch people in the face. So he does that punch, like the one punch knockout with the guy, he's going to take his boat. And then he doesn't say a word to Tyrion and just smacks him in the face. So I thought that was pretty great, because you kind of got this little, okay, this is going to be a Jaime Brienne vibe, where now Tyrion's captive and he's just going to try to exchange barbs with his captor. Jorah's not having any of it.
Right. No, and so Jorah's always, for me, been a necessary but sort of disposable character. I think a lot of it has to do with the slow burn of being interested in Dany. And
well, he only ever had one note, right?
Right. Yeah.
His one note was to kind of like, I'm devoted to Dany. I'm devoted to Dany, and I'm never. You're never going to see me raise my voice. I'm always going to be stoic. Even when I dissent from Dany, I won't show much emotion about it. So this is a whole different Jorah we're seeing.
Yes. Yeah, so that helps.
All right, let me tell you something that didn't work for me. The death of Barristan Selmy. I think I'm supposed to care, and I just don't care.
No, you know what? That's a really good point. I very much had the same feeling.
Yeah, I feel like they were... They should have done more for him to sort of make me care about him.
I think, and this feels accelerated. This feels very much like, hey, look, we're going to have a little bit of a moment with Dany that we talk about singing, and we're going to show a human side of him, and it's going to show a certain connectivity between the two of them, so that's going to matter. But it's I think that it was too little too late, and it was too forced.
I actually kind of like the scene where he was talking about her older brother and
right. No, that's all fine.
This is kind of working for me. I could see this. He kind of sliding into this Jorah Mormont role.
We'll do that an episode before,
or do that several episodes before, and then
and
make him interesting.
Right. Yeah. Because at this point, he's not right. He's just right. This is supposed to be one of those episodes where you're like, whoa, my gosh, I can't believe it. It's episode four and we've seen this much death and they killed off this character. So it fell flat if that was the intent, in my opinion, because Barristan.
Right. I think it fell flat if that was the intent. I think that the secondary intent is to create a little bit of a small council vacuum around Dany.
Right.
So
which timing wise is perfect, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because so you've got Tyrion on the way.
And so Tyrion and Jorah are coming back. I want to do a little bit of backstory. We hear a lot about Rhaegar Targaryen in this episode. Mm-hmm. So just
great video game, Rhaegar the Targaryen. I think it was NES, not to be mistaken with Karnov. Karnov, of course, being the fire breathing, pudgy Russian. That wore no shirt. I don't know if you remember that one.
I do not remember that.
Yeah, little guy. I think he just wore pants. He had a mustache.
Well, I do like my Russian men shirtless.
So this would be right up there with you. Because I think he breathed fire. Very reminiscent of somebody who would be like at a circus breathing fire. The shirtless, pudgy Russian. But only this was the one that got into adventures.
Let me tell you about Rhaegar, because he was mentioned in the Littlefinger Sansa conversation. You know, they were looking at the statue of Lyanna Stark, who was Ned's sister. Apparently, the story there is that Rhaegar Targaryen kidnapped and raped her. So that's the official story. And that's actually what made Robert Baratheon want to go to war and overthrow the Mad King, because of what happened to his beloved Lyanna. So there's that part of it. And then we hear sort of a different version of his character from Barristan Selmy, who actually knew him and said, actually, he was a great guy. He loved to sing. He gave away money. In Barristan's eyes, this guy just seems like he would have been a great king, right? He was next in line for the throne. He probably would have been a lot better than his father. And Rhaegar is then married to Elia Martell. That was the whole Mountain and Viper business, because Oberyn wants to avenge his sister, Elia Martell. Right. Okay, well, Rhaegar ends up falling in love with Lyanna Stark. And it's kind of this public, like everyone kind of knows about it. And what ends up happening is, the official narrative is anyway, he kidnaps Lyanna Stark because he's mad with lust for her or something like that. And this causes Robert to go to war, and the rest is history. And the only reason that I'm filling you in on that backstory is because Martin loves to bring up like a political mistake from like 20 years ago and then show like a 20-year long consequence for something like that.
Well, and it adds a certain level of gravity to the decisions that are being made.
Right.
Everything that they're doing now, we're set into motion from years past, and then this will continue to set things in motion the way, which shows the criticality of these decisions, right?
That's right. And it suggests that some of this Rhaegar plot is going to come back into the story at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Dismemberment count. A horse loses his leg, Steve, when Bronn is being attacked by the men of Dorne. He takes off a horse's leg.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And I'm not sure what happens to that snake. That snake probably gets cut in half. I think that if you cut a snake in half, that counts as dismemberment, right?
I think so. Right? I mean, I think any part of a snake cut off is dismembering, because it's just member.
All right. Something that did not work for you in this episode.
Well, it did not work for me. Yeah. It's Dorne, baby. The daughters of Oberyn, that scene was
it's pretty bad.
One of the worst scenes in this series thus far.
You know what, Steve? In Dorne, they like poison and they like the monologue.
It's rough, dude.
Dornish people love to monologue. And sometimes it gets...
be great if they were good at it.
Sometimes it gets their head popped in. And sometimes it results in someone else's head being impaled. But they love to monologue. And I tell you what, man, no one wants to be around someone who likes to monologue.
No, and it was just so stilted, and any moment of drama in that sequence was just cringy. And I
yeah,
just,
it's not good.
Immediately, I'm like, I'm not going to enjoy any of this plot. I can't. I won't. even a head with scorpions on it wasn't enough.
Here's how much I didn't like this scene, because this didn't work for me either. So I was making my notes and I was writing down the names of the daughters, Nim, Obera, and then I like wrote down like a blank line, like later on I got to go look up this other person's name, and I didn't do it because I didn't care.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
It really doesn't matter. I don't need to know this other, the third daughter's name.
No, I know. So. It's funny because, like, again, it's the same kind of approach that we've discussed. You know, here I am watching this series, knowing that there's this kind of this outcry against, you know, it feels like it's careening towards disappointment.
Yeah.
As we get into the last seasons. And so knowing that, the hope is that I will be able to mine the good out of it and maybe just allow.
Yeah, because you're not going to be nearly as built up as everyone else was. Right.
Right. I'm expecting to be let down. So maybe I don't watch these episodes going forward with the expectations that everybody else was going from.
So that's how bad this scene was, because I told you this was the bad season. And so your expectations were low.
Right. And so like the last episode we talked about, I'm like, hey, it was good. I think everything pretty much worked. But so I'm like, all right, I'm willing to give. And then as soon as we got on the Dorne, I'm already like, because I don't even like the Dorne sequence in the opening credits.
Sure.
Just like, ah. Just, and yeah. It's weird because it's like, it's so hard to put my finger on it. It's just like anything Dorne is just not, it does not move me. And this was, wow, real bad.
Hey, speaking of opening credits, looks like they've put some Flayed Man imagery in Winterfell. Did you catch that?
Yeah, because it's not burning anymore.
That's right.
They got the banners up. And just, you know, as a side note, I don't know if there's supposed to be lyrics to the theme song, but it, as far as I sing it every time, it's always just Peter Dinklage, Peter Dinklage, Peter Dinklage. Peter Dinklage, Peter Dinklage, Peter Dinklage.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right. I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season two.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to introduce you to a prince that we will meet in House of the Dragon. So this is just a little taste of the character that the famous Matt Smith will take on in the coming year. Mild spoilers for House of the Dragon, but I will say this. I don't think I'm going to read to you anything that's going to reveal too much about the plot. Just a few pages here, and just enough to introduce you to the character of Daemon Targaryen. This is a short story called The Rogue Prince, or A King's Brother, that was published in a collection of short stories, and the book is called Rogues. This is the final chapter of that book. Over the centuries, House Targaryen has produced both great men and monsters. Prince Daemon was both. In his days, there was not a man so admired, so beloved, and so reviled in all of Westeros. He was made of light and darkness in equal parts. To some he was a hero, to others the blackest of villains. No true understanding of that most tragic bloodletting known as the Dance of Dragons is possible without consideration of the crucial role played before and during this conflict by the Rogue Prince. The paragraphs that follow introduce some of the other key characters, but I'm just going to skip ahead so I can tell you a little bit more about Daemon. As charming as he was hot-tempered, Prince Daemon had earned his knight's spurs at 6 and 10 and had been given Dark Sister by the old king himself in recognition of his prowess. Though he had wed the Lady of Runestone in 97 AC during the old king's reign, the marriage had not been a success. Skipping over description of his poor wife and his short tenure as Master of Coin, I'll jump to the next paragraph. Governance bored this warrior prince, however. He did better when King Viserys made him commander of the city watch. Finding the watchmen ill-armed and clad in oddments and rags, Daemon equipped each man with a dirk, short sword, and cudgel, armored them in black ringmail with breastplates for the officers, and gave them long golden cloaks that they might wear with pride. Ever since, the men of the city watch have been known as the Gold Cloaks. Prince Daemon took eagerly to the work of the Gold Cloaks, and off prowled the alleys of King's Landing with his men. That he made the city more orderly no man could doubt, but his discipline was a brutal one. He delighted in the cutting off of hands, of pickpockets, gelding rapists, and slitting the noses of thieves, and slew 3 men in street brawls during his first year as commander. Before long, the prince was well known in all the low places of King's Landing. He became a familiar sight in wineskins, where he drank for free, and gambling pits, where he always left with more coin than when he entered. As King Viserys has no living son, Daemon regarded himself as the rightful heir to the Iron Throne and coveted the title Prince of Dragonstone, which his grace refused to grant him. But by the end of the year, 105 AC, he was known to his friends as the Prince of the City and to the small folk as Lord Fleabottom. Though the king did not wish Daemon to succeed him, he remained fond of his younger brother and was quick to forgive him his many offenses. Skipping ahead again, King Viserys never claimed another dragon after Balerion's death, nor did he have much taste for the joust, the hunt, or swordplay, whereas Prince Daemon excelled in these spheres and seemed all that his brother was not.
lean and hard, a renowned warrior, dashing, daring, more than a little dangerous. So that, as promised, was just a taste of Daemon Targaryen, who we will meet in the coming year in the newest HBO adaptation. And I think, as these few pages show, Martin does indeed like his knights to be light and dark at once, to be gray characters. This, I think, is Martin's answer to the ideals of chivalry. On a side note, I am looking forward to House of the Dragon, and I hope you are too. And that is all for this week.